My name is Terry Brown, and I live in Bundaberg. And today's date is the 13th of November 2011. And we're in Bundaberg, and we're recording the Story Project. And I'd like to introduce you to my wife, Valerie.
Thank you, Terry. Well, yes, we're really enjoying this, taking part in the Story Project. And both Terry and I were children in London during the Blitz in World War II. And this is uppermost in my mind as one of the important parts of my life that I wrote a poem about, because I was concerned about the children that went through the Blitz. And I've called it The Children Who Never Were. And I wondered if you'd like to hear it.
Yes.
It says, "See the children coming out of the bomb debris, resting after their game of soldiers, aping their fathers, uncles and elder brothers with saucepans on their heads and wooden Tommy guns, make-believe bullets and bombs going ping, pow, pom, pom, pom. They make no danger, no death, no mortal wounds. They played their games where they wouldn't disturb the adults, lived their fantasies of a glorious war with only winners amidst the grave reality of a mass of losers. The children were the losers, though they didn't know it. Home now to the illusion of tea and buttered crumpets beside the fire, the welcome of warm, loving arms, bright flowers from the garden, glowing mellow furniture, and the soothing lullabies of Vera Lynn. But in reality, it was home to the truth of bread and scrape, welcoming arms, protective and constrictive, a heart full of its own pain that must be hidden from the children. Gas masks reminding that even the breath of life is rationed. A tomb-like air raid shelter submerged in the garden, a damp and musty womb in which to preserve life. Home to the stiff upper lip of Winston Churchill, and a piece of a favourite chair in flickering embers in the grate. Austerity is no comfort for insecurity. Nightmares, no release from fear. Stifled tears, no solace in sadness. No answers to questions, and then no questions came because there were no answers. Soon, there were no children, for they grew up suddenly when the adults became deaf and blind to their emotional cries in the battle for survival, and the Blitz blacked out their childhood. When the lights go on again, there'll be bluebirds all over. What does that mean when they have known only darkness and they can't see the difference between a sunset and the glow of burning homes? And is a bluebird really a sparrow with the grime and the soot cleaned off? See the teenagers coming out of the bomb debris, remembering their childish game of soldiers. The rubble has settled now, and there are flowers to pick. Fancy golden rain and columbine flourish there. No more battles, only hide and seek, treasure hunts and pretend gold mining as if searching for their lost childhood of freedom and joy. Will they ever find it? See the grown men coming out of the bomb debris, repairing the damage of so many years ago, excavating the past and then laying new foundations of compassion and understanding of the way life has to grow. Rebuilding for the future generations a childhood full of joy and freedom, the heritage they lost when their childhood was interrupted by a game of soldiers."
Oh, very good. That's years since I've heard that. I hardly remember anything about it. Oh, yeah, I'd only vaguely remember of you reading that years ago. I wanted to avoid talking about the war for a little bit, and because I had some other things that might be of interest they'll bring back memories to you, Valerie, too. I was going to start off with something called the Never Never.
High purchase.
Before the days of credit cards, high purchase, bank loans, you either had to pay cash if you were rich or go without. And someone invented the idea of a man coming around the door and knocking on the door every week at the same time, the same day, and collecting money that you owe for a loan he'd made to buy clothes, shoes, any necessities. And I remember he was called the Never Never Man.
Or the Tally Man.
And yes. And
did you hide from him?
Well, if we ran out of money on necessities like food, before he arrived, Mum used to get us all to hide behind the settee and be absolutely quiet, and she'd keep peeping out to see when he's left and gone away, because he thought there was no one home. And I remember you telling me that used to happen to you. But I remember cash wasn't paid for anything. We couldn't afford it. So if our children needed new clothes or shoes, they used to get them on day. Never, never.
Well, money was all short, wasn't it?
Yes.
But did your mother do what my mother used to do? We had gas meters and electric meters in the cupboard under the stairs.
I know what you're going to say.
And to get enough gas to cook the Sunday dinner, we used to have to put money in.
Yes.
And sometimes there were pennies and sometimes there were shillings, depending on how well off we were at the time. And the same with the electricity meter. And then a man would come around every 2 months or so and empty, with a special key, he'd empty this meter and tally up with you. My mother found that certain foreign coins worked quite well.
My mother did.
You couldn't spend them in the shops face to face, but you could put them in the electric or the gas meters and get a shilling's worth of gas or whatever from this foreign coin. However, the reckoning came when the man came to open the machine and have a look, and he used to call them foreigners, didn't he?
Well, our man didn't. Martin never said a word. He used to pick out all the foreign coins and put them to one side, and Mum had to pay him the equivalent in pennies or shillings. Yeah. And then
What did she do with the foreign coins,
They used to sit on top of the meter to be used all over again the next month. That shows you how poor we were in those days. But we never saw ourselves as poor. We thought it was very ordinary. And because all our neighbours were exactly the same. We did come from a very poor area of London, and everyone was in the same position, and I don't think anyone saw themselves as being poor. Certainly, it was well below what they call living below the poverty line now. Poor is worse than that. Anyway, so I wanted to just bring that up. And another thing, that truancy. I only ever played truancy once, that is, taking a day off from school unannounced. And the reason I never ever done it a second time is because when I got home, making sure I arrived exactly the same time as I would have done from coming home from school, my mother was standing at the open door with my father's belt hanging down in her hand. And she said, "Did you play truant today?" And I said, I didn't say yes or no, I just said, "How do you know?" And she said, "Because the school board man's been here." Now, the school board man was a school inspector. And if someone was ticked absent at school, there was actually an inspector who went round the suburbs checking on the children to see if they were sick in bed or if they were playing truant. Mm. Yeah, and so there was very, very little absentees from school in those days. Mm. They don't even, there's a long time since they've employed school inspectors to do that. And, that brings me then to the policeman. The policeman didn't have the luxury of cruising around in cars, and so they were seen all the time. Several times a day you'd see a policeman either walking the beat or doing the beat on his bicycle. And when they really got modern, someone invented a completely silent motorcycle. I remember what they were, L.E. Velocette.
Oh, yeah, the water-cooled
anyway,
ones.
Yeah. And completely silent, and they would ride them around the streets. So if children were doing something wrong, a policeman could suddenly arrive fast and unannounced on his silent motorcycle. just things that come back in my mind.
We always used to regard the policemen as friends. And if we wanted help or we wanted to know anything,
yeah, that's right.
Then we asked the policemen, literally, and they would help us.
Yeah.
At the same time, if they saw any boys misbehaving themselves, they weren't averse to giving them a cuff around
the
ear.
No, that's right.
They
would send them give you what we used to call a clip round the ear. That is a swift smack on the back of the head that didn't hurt. It was glancing, a sort of glancing blow, but it frightened you. And being a policeman, you thought, gee, I must be doing something wrong, or I must be, I'm being not really naughty here, as a, quite small children. And so, we were brought up self-regulated, really, or the threat of the police, school teachers, the school board man, parents, everyone was a threat.
But at the same time, Terry, wasn't there that wonderful feeling of freedom? You know, do you remember in school holidays, most kids had a bike eventually, and it was quite a common thing to leave home at 9 o'clock in the morning after breakfast with a bag of sandwiches and a bottle of water on your bike, no telephones, no way of communicating home if you were in any trouble. It was up to you. You had to look after yourself and make sure that you were responsible, make sure that you didn't get into any scrapes that you couldn't get out of. And the only instructions were, Mum would say, make sure you're home by the time the street lights go on.
There was never any trouble to get into. That's right. And, that brings me to, you mentioned bicycles. I don't remember any friends having a bicycle when at school age. That's right, up to 14, from 10 to 14. My first bicycle I had to buy myself because no one else would. And I bought that on the Never Never again. And before I'd left school, I was about 13, and I got a morning paper round, which most boys and some girls did. And that's how you paid for your bicycle. Most boys don't have paper and girls to pay for their bicycle. And it took several weeks. Now, I had to meet the train with the newspapers on at 6 a.m, make up my paper round, writing all the addresses down out of a book, and then about 7 o'clock, I would start delivering them, and at 8:30, I would finish, race home, gulp down something, and rush off to get to school at 9 o'clock. And that was every morning that happened.
It would have been dark in England in
pitch black and snow as well.
In the winter.
I remember once I came off my bike in the snow and all the newspapers skidded across the road and I had to go back and reassess them and reformulate them. Anyway, and that's a very, very proud day that I always remember. Of course, it's clear, very clear to me now that I took possession of my brand new bicycle that I spent weeks and weeks to pay for on the Never Never. And I suddenly thought also some of the things we used to do after school to play, and I remember that some of the games we used to play, mostly with a ball, five stones, we called them gods, but nothing.
Yo-yos, they went in crazes, didn't they?
Yes, yo-yos. In Australia, they were called five stones. I haven't seen them for years. Anyway, we had all these games with balls. And also, I remember one game, you used to use things. You didn't buy toys. There was no toys for many years. And you couldn't afford to buy them when there was. So we used to make them ourselves, as I said before. Some big kid got a truck tyre from somewhere, an old worn-out truck tyre, and he said to me, "Our kid, curl up and sit in there," which, silly me, I did. And we're at the top of a hill. Fortunately, there was very little traffic in those days, and he pushed, and this wheel ran down the road with me inside, going over and over and over and over, and at the bottom of the hill, it went bang against the wall, bounced back, shook me out, and I fell out in a heap. And I stood up and kept falling over, because everyone was all crowding around, roaring and laughing, because I couldn't walk in a straight line. I was so giddy, and I had to sit down again. And that's the sort of things we used to do, and we called that good fun. And yes,
the girls were quite safe with their lengths of string tied into a circle, and they used to manipulate them between the hands into patterns. That was called Cat's Cradle, and it used to go on and on forever and ever. And these patterns were all designs, and then the hand clapping games. It was all on handstands against the wall, and all the ball games against a brick wall.
Because girls didn't play conkers.
Oh, no.
The game of conkers is where the boys used to knock horse chestnut seeds down off of a tree.
They're like chestnuts, but bigger.
Yes.
Chestnuts, but bigger.
Only much bigger, yeah.
The dark brown shells.
About as big as a golf ball. And we'd drill a hole through the middle with a skewer, put a string through, and then you try to hit each other's... a boy would have one each, and you try to hit each other's to break the other conker. And when you did, when you first started off, that your conker was worth one. That was a score. But the scores used to get up to 60 and 70.
Well, according to how many other conkers your conker had busted.
So if I had a conker that was worth 60, that meant I had broken 60 other conkers. And then if someone broke mine, they would add that 60 to their score. The amazing thing is, we were scrupulously honest about it.
Oh, I know some kids used to put theirs in the oven and bake them to make them hard.
Yeah, oh, no, that was just a...
Soak them in vinegar, didn't they?
That's just to make an improvement. But it was honest, always scrupulously honest with the count. Another thing is billy carts. Boys made billy carts. Girls always wanted a ride on them. We said, no, girls don't ride billy carts. Boys and girls didn't mix, did they? They had their own games.
Yeah.
Anyway, spinning tops was another one. Yeah, I thought I'd mention that because it might be interesting, because I haven't seen most of these games played for a long time now.
What about Guy Fawkes Night? Did you get pushed around on a trolley pretending?
Oh, we used to make a
penny,
guy.
Penny for the guy.
Yeah. This was never... When we arrived in Australia in 1966, Guy Fawkes Night was celebrated, as were everything British. It's all faded away now, and it hasn't been...
Wasn't called Guy Fawkes Night. It was just called Fireworks Night.
Oh, right. Well, anyway, it was to celebrate Guy Fawkes trying to blow up the Houses of Parliament a couple of hundred years ago. We used to make a guy, and some of them are very, very clever, very lifelike... rather like a scarecrow in a farmer's paddock. Anyway, but we decided we couldn't be bothered with all that, and so they dressed me up, stuffed straw down up my sleeves and down my front so that bits of straw were sticking out, put a mask on, which you used to buy on Guy Fawkes to celebrate Guy Fawkes or Bonfire Night, and I had to sit in this chair absolutely motionless when someone walked by, and they say, oh, gee, that's a good... Guy, oh, you've done a good job there, boys, and throw pennies in the hat. And we collected a lot of money like that. But I had to hold my breath in case someone noticed, because it's bound to happen in the end. Some big kid of about 18 come along and said, that's not a proper guy. He picked up a stick and poked me in the tummy. And of course, I let out a yell, and the whole thing was ruined. Then we had to give it away. Then, yeah. I thought I'd mention these things because they just don't happen now, do they?
No. Old boys were rough, rude creatures in those days.
Something... I won't apologise for going back to the war years, because in time to come it might be very interesting. Little bits and pieces that never reached the newspaper wouldn't do nowadays. Your father... Barrage balloons. They were put up on a... They're filled with gas... And they were put up on a long steel cable, very high in the air, and they were in bunches over the course of about a mile or 2 miles. And they put them up right in the path of the bombers that were coming to London. And it wasn't that the bombers were flying to the balloons, they could see them, but they couldn't see the cables. And quite often, very few flew into them, but they had to detour around. And, of course, then the gunners would be waiting for them with the anti-aircraft guns. So it was rather a good scheme. Now, your father used to work on them.
Yes, he was in the Royal Air Force, and he was stationed as... Look, they were called barrage balloons. Huge, great big silver rubber or plastic things. And he used to be in a platoon that was looking after them in certain areas. My father joined the Royal Air Force at the beginning of the war, and the reason he joined was because he didn't have a job, and he knew that people were going to get called up as enlisted, and so he thought he would volunteer first because he might be first in line for a new pair of boots or something, because he didn't have any shoes. He couldn't afford to buy shoes. And I think a lot of men did that. There was a depression going on.
They not only gave him boots for the duration of the war, but
a uniform.
When they were demobbed or demobilised, they called it demob, they were given a suit, weren't they? They were given a suit and a pair of boots.
They all got everybody that was leaving, because they were leaving with no clothes.
That's right, nothing.
So they got issued with what they called a demob suit, which was, I do remember, it was almost exactly the same, but near enough, all coarse material,
cheap,
wasn't it?
Yeah, very cheap. Nasty.
Trousers, a waistcoat and a jacket and a pair of shoes. And gratuity.
Yeah, that wasn't much.
I know, but my father, though they were supposed to be able to do something with it, but my father put his money in with three other men and tried to form a business. But I don't think any of them had very good qualifications, but they started a building business and started repairing all the bomb damaged houses for the government. But it didn't last long. He worked a long time there for something like £2 a week, and it was awful. We were poor then. That was after the war. And all around everybody, it was the Battle of Britain, the Festival of Britain, and the Queen's wedding, and then her coronation. There was all these lovely things, all buoying people up, wasn't there? The grounds that they made, the Festival of Britain, everything was done to give people a bit of a lift. Yeah,
after
emotionally and spiritually.
War, yes.
Yeah. Mm.
But something you mentioned there that you didn't necessarily mean to, it was about when you mentioned, oh, I forget what it was you said now, it reminded me of the coronation. I was on the Queen's coronation
parade list, weren't you?
Yeah.
And but by this time, you were in the forces yourself.
Yes, I was in
the
Air Force myself, in national service. And also, but I was going to say, that reminded me of something else. Do you know, my earliest memory was at the coronation of George the VI.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that goes back. That was, I think you'll find, that was 1937. And I was a little tiny boy. And the only thing I remember about it was that the men were street entertainers. And there were one man tied another one up with chains and ropes. And of course, I was so tiny, no one explained to me that they were entertaining, that they were only make believe and making it. And I burst into tears and said to my mum, "They're tying that man up." And she kept saying, "No, that's all right." And I was saying, "No, it isn't. No, it isn't." And
you're talking about buskers.
Yeah, that is
street
entertainers. Street entertainers, yeah. Not buskers. No, just street entertainers. They used to get up to all manner of tricks to entertain people. Anyway, but that was George the VI coronation then that I was talking about. The Queen Elizabeth's coronation, and what was the name of that skyline, wasn't it? They built for the Festival of Britain.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, you're going back a bit now, Terry.
Well, that was what you was talking about, the Festival of Britain. Mm. It was about, I think it was 1950 or 1951. Mm. Anyway.
But by this time we were teenagers, weren't we?
Yes, and anyway.
You mentioned King George the VI.
Yes.
I remembered when he died. I was working in the City of London, And at a certain time that it was predetermined after he died, as a mark of respect, they stopped everything, every single thing. And this is in the City of London, which was then the hub of the world's commercial business and dealings. And I was on my lunch hour, and I was just about to go into a shop, and then suddenly the signal came to stop for 2 minutes. And I found myself cheek by jowl with this dirty old man who was coming out of the shop. And so I had to stand there, stock still, right next to him. And everybody did. All the cars stopped. All the machinery in the offices were switched off. Everything was silent for 2 minutes as a mark of respect. And then at the end of it, as they broke it and it went back to normal, somebody in the crowd shouted out, "You should think of the living." Obviously, he was a returned soldier, I think. It was sad, wasn't it, to see all the soldiers come back that were all marked. And
yes.
A lot of them had plastic surgery on their faces for their victims of burns.
Yes. Well, a lot of fighter pilots were completely disfigured for life with burns where they couldn't get out quick enough.
Yeah.
Anyway, something I wanted to bring up here that might be of interest. You didn't have to carry a gas mask because you was evacuated, weren't you? Did you ever see people?
No. Oh. Well, I can't remember. I know that I had a gas mask, but I didn't have to wear it.
No. Well, we had to carry them constantly. They were in a little cardboard box, and they were strung around our necks on a piece of string.
Yeah, remember
and
that.
We carried, and they was on out the small of our back, and we went everywhere with them except for to bed. We took them off to go to bed because there's always the threat of a gas attack because mustard gas was used in the trenches in the First World War, and they just assumed naturally that it would be used in the Second, and it never was. But we thought it's a huge joke when we were fitted in the school for gas masks, because there were three types depending on your age. I had an adult's one, and my younger brother had what they called a Mickey Mouse one, because Mickey Mouse was just been invented then, and so Mickey Mouse things are very popular.
Was it made of red rubber?
It was all made of rubber, but this one was bright red, and it had big ears sticking out of it.
Mm.
And the idea was to encourage small children to wear a gas mask. And it worked, because when they found out that when they blew out instead of breathing in, it made a rasping noise. Rather than what we used to, as kids, we used to call it making rude noises.
Yeah, raspers. Yeah.
But my sister, who was a baby, had to be put inside one, and it looked exactly like you'd imagine an astronaut's mask nowadays.
Oh, it's like an incubator, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Well, yeah. The mother had to put the baby in and stand in and pump. And if she stopped pumping, the child would suffocate. And so if the mother was injured during a raid, the baby would die because it couldn't get, no one was there pumping air in. All these little things, I don't think people in those days may not have known about it very much, or certainly soon after the war.
And there was something else then that people didn't know about very much was the little bombs that the enemy used to drop into the countryside that would land in bushes. They'd come down on little parachutes and land in bushes. And they were particularly made attractive to children, and like butterflies or birds. And people and the kids would see them in the bushes, and once they touched them, then they would explode.
Yeah, they were like hand grenades painted like butterflies.
Yeah.
They were called butterfly bombs. Anyway, but something I didn't mention before as well was what they called the V1s and V2s. But we had a name for, or the people had a name for the V1s, didn't they?
Doodlebugs.
They were technically a flying bomb. It was a pilotless plane, but with the whole plane was a bomb. And they had a terrifying noise is an unusual engine. It was a quick, cheap engine, and they made a horrible noise.
But that was intentional, wasn't it?
Yeah, but you'd never forget the noise. It's terrifying, very loud. But the most terrifying thing was when the engine cut out.
Yeah.
And they would find out their destination. They would measure the destination they had to fly with the amount of fuel they put in. And they knew exactly when the engine was going to cut out and where the bomb was going to fall. And so they were aimed at wharf areas, factory areas and things like that. And when I saw several during the war, and several I remember the engine cutting out, but one in particular was right over the top of our heads, very, very low, just above the rooftop of houses, and the engine stopped. Well, a very funny thing happened, actually. It was quite normal then. My mum, dad and myself ran into the nearest shop, which is a greengrocer's, and didn't say a word. We just ran behind the counter and dived underneath the counter. Mm. And the funny thing was, when we got there, we found the owner of the shop and his wife were already hiding under the counter. They'd beaten us to it. And fortunately, because from then on it sloped downhill, it then travelled for about another kilometre before it.
But that was it, that was intended to terrify the
civilians. Oh, yes, yeah, it worked.
Civilians,
it did terrify us. Yeah. And the other one was called, well, later they got more sophisticated. They made a V2, and this was a V2. This was a rocket, and it was the first rockets made, and it was invented and built by von Braun, a man called von Braun, German man. And later he was very quickly captured by the Americans, flown over to America, and he worked on the first American rockets in the space program. Yeah. And but they weren't too bad, as much as you never heard them come in. They made no noise at all. The first thing you knew was the big explosion, the big bang when they went off. And they weren't so terrifying as the V1s. Oh, and all the snippets of little information is probably won't be much of interest for most people, but you never know. Someone might be doing research and they need to know these things in the future. You didn't have to go around air raid shelters, but you tell us about them anyway. You knew about them. You saw them, didn't you?
Well, the air raid shelters?
Air raid shelters, all different types.
Well, they were built in the streets for anybody who was out and about when the air raid... Well, you haven't mentioned the air raid warnings, which were awful, weren't they?
Can you tell us about them?
And just a wavering noise that was intended to alarm people and make them scurry for the nearest shelter. But if you were at home, you had one in your back garden. And if you were out, you had a public one. But in London, I know, a lot of people used the tube stations as their shelters, and it was a regular thing. They had their own posses down there, and they used to have entertainers and used to take your supper down there and finish cooking it if you had to. And
all your bedding.
Oh, yeah, all the bedding.
The tube is what's also known as the underground railway system of London.
Mm.
They're very deep underground, or some of them are very, very deep, and that's the ones that's used as air raid shelters for the people in the centre of London. But there was an interesting one indoors. If you lived in a unit, a flat, you know, if you didn't have any backyard to dig a hole and make an Anderson shelter, the government issued you with a dining table that was... about an inch, or no, what inch in those days, is about 25 millimetre thick steel. It needed several workmen to carry it in. Oblong, about 2 metres long by 1 metre wide, and that was on very steel frame or stanchions. And this was set up, and you put through a tablecloth over the top, and that was your dining table. But if an air raid came, you dived underneath this table, and it had... what I can only describe as cyclone fencing all around.
Oh, yeah,
it was
very like a mesh.
Very, very thick mesh with a little door at one end. And you dived in there and you closed the door And you also had some bedding already under this dining table, and you just stayed there until the all clear went. And if your house came down on top of you, you just sat there until someone dug you out. It was very simple and straightforward, but it might sound a bit terrifying now, but it was all taken for granted. People say, you got an Anderson or a Morrison shelter, and, you know, things like that. And
I think that was the thing about those days, though, wasn't it? You did take it for granted. You took all these food shortages and the shortage of money and the inconvenience of everything, of everyday life. After 5 years, it became almost habit.
Well, it became normal very quickly. Something I must put in quickly is I watched the Battle of Britain. It's now become part of history, the Battle of Britain. I stood outside our Anderson shelter, and it was a bright, beautiful, sunny, cloudless day on a Sunday, and everyone just stood there looking up in the air, watching all these, what they used to call dogfights. It was usually Hurricanes and Spitfires versus Focke Wulf 109s and Messerschmitts 110s. Mm. And it went on for hours. And planes were coming down in flames, parachutes were coming down. And the people were always shouting, is that one of theirs or one of ours? But you couldn't, it wasn't immediately identifiable. Yeah, I remember that. And anyway, so it's a rather sad note, isn't it, to finish on. Did you have anything you wanted to add now? I've run out of ideas now.
That might be a good place to stop then.